convinced that it's taken me to describe this to you, we've traveled approximately 20,000 miles. And none of us felt a thing. So my point is, if gravity wasn't on your gratitude list this morning, you might want to consider having it. Kind of like God's seatbelt. So as we travel the universe, and we find that in this, our little AA community, it's a very small world. And we all hear stories all the time about, man, I went to New York and found this little hole in the wall meeting, and there sat Crazy Larry, you know, and you know, went over here to Egypt and met a friend of Bill W. So even if we're not at a meeting, we're bumping into friends of Bill W. everywhere. And what a gift and what a blessing, you know, that we have this seat on this beautiful spaceship, Mother Earth, that we get to travel together, and that we made it, you know, through from our past to be able to have this seat here. And it's definitely something to be grateful for. My best story to date is almost a year ago. I traveled to Europe and got off the boat in Italy and walked a few feet on land and came face to face with our speaker this morning and her husband. And they're both very active people in our AA community and in our San Antonio community, very active. And I first met Carol in the 1980s when we sobered up together. And she's a lovely, lovely person. And we're all looking forward to hearing your story this morning, Miss Carol. Come on up.
Carol.
Hey, Carol.
My sobriety date is January 1st, 1985, and for that I'm very, very grateful. And to Alcoholics Anonymous and Club 12 in particular, because this is where I sobered up. And this is where I found my new family. All my real family were in England, and so this is where I found, you know, new friends, new family. I was born in England in a little town called Chard. Kind of between Bristol and Bath, about 150 miles south of London. And once I got to my teenage years, I just wanted to get out of there. It was small, nothing was ever going on, but I never imagined coming to the United States. And now, you know, Greg and I, we just love going back to that same little town. It was different. The first time I went back after I was sober, you know, I just loved it. Everything was different after I got sober. But anyhow, I am the oldest of four kids. I have a brother and two sisters. And, you know, when I first got in here and started thinking back about my childhood, I tried to find out what that missing link was. What was it, I wonder, that changed me from a happy-go-lucky little girl who was kind of outspoken into the person I became later on. And I think I was about 3 years sober. Suddenly dawned on me, I was an only child for 5 years. And then in a year and a half, my mom had my brother and then my sister. And so she was really busy. And so I kind of lost my spot as a little, you know, just the one kid in the family. And also, around the time I was 7 or 8, I met my very best friend, Kim. And I didn't really think about where we lived or, you know, what our lifestyle was like or anything. I was quite happy. But Kim had, I suddenly wanted her life. She lived in a beautiful home. She had all the kind of toys and stuff that I didn't have. She had her own bedroom, huge big bedroom. And she had beautiful clothes, these lovely dresses, matching panties too. And when I first went over to her house and she opened her closet, there are these beautiful dresses. And so from that time, I've been discontent crept into my life, because that was a really strong thread throughout my life, discontent. I suddenly, you know, our home didn't look so good. And the other thing that I was really envious of was her daddy. He was a loving, kind man, really involved in Werner Brothers' life. He was very demonstrative. My dad wasn't. My dad was very strict. And I don't remember that until the other kids came along. And a lot changed then. I think my mom got overwhelmed, you know, with raising three kids. My dad was stingy. And he just thought it was mom's job to raise us. And he really didn't have a lot to do with that, with us. And so I really started looking then for acceptance and love and approval for my dad, which he was unable to give. You know, I know now that he did the very best he could, and I love my dad dearly. And how I got to this point was a total miracle, and because of this program. But this discontent and hurt about my dad and how he treated us, treated me in particular, as I was the eldest, turned into anger and then really, really deep-seated resentment as I got older. And that was, along with the discontent, that was the one emotion that really ran me, was resentment toward my dad. And as I got older, he just seemed to be worse. And nothing I did made him say he was proud of me or, you know, acknowledge me, really. And like all of us, I was insecure, always measuring myself up against someone else. And when I was 11, back in England, we used to have an exam that you took at 11 years old called the 11th class. If you passed it, you went to an all-girls school or a boys' school. And it was a really good education. But I passed this test. And I was so sure that this one thing, Dad was going to finally say, I'm so proud of you, Carol. Good girl. He never said anything. Never even acknowledged it, really. And the problem was with this school, it was a great school, but all the girls in my school were really smart. And so, you know, I was pretty smart, but I was always measuring myself against the girls who did better in my class. And so, in everything, I saw myself as falling short. And so, when I had my first drink at 17, immediately, it hit the spot. I felt different. I mean, immediately. It was like, oh my God, this is so wonderful. I didn't get rip-roaring drunk that night. I had several drinks, but I thought, oh my God, this is wonderful. It changed how I felt about myself. Suddenly I felt like I fit in. You know, and I never felt like I fit in. Same old scenario of we didn't fit in. And I always felt like something was inherently wrong with me. And I heard this from a lady who spoke at the International Convention. She said, you know, I always thought there was something wrong with me. Into AA, I found that there was something really wrong with me. And that, you know, there was, but that feeling.
We got it.
So I didn't start drinking a lot right away. The thought was there. Ooh, when we go out, when it's a special occasion, when it's Christmas, when it's birthdays, I can drink. And I honestly don't remember ever having one drink. Maybe I just had two if we went out at lunchtime with my workmates or something like that. But it was always in my mind because it just made me feel so darn good. And it made those feelings of insecurity and unhappiness go away. So I've met my ex-husband by now. We got married when I was 20. First few years are okay, you know, but when I go out, I'm getting drunk. And about three or so years into that marriage, we always had a liquor cabinet. But, you know, it would stay stocked. I was talking to my son about this the other day. It would stay stocked for a long time. But as years went on, I was constantly filling that liquor cabinet up. And the same thing happened that happens for us. I just drank on the weekends, I'd be fine. Then I was drinking during the week. And then I was drinking at lunchtime. I remember one time being at work, and I came back from work, I had a few drinks, and I fell asleep on my typewriter. And one of the instructors came in, I said, oh, I don't feel very sick. What's going on? Are you all right? I said, oh, I don't feel very good. I think I must have the flu coming on. And I had the flu and bronchitis a lot. There was sort of a turning point, though, in my drinking and the way I thought about it. In February of 1977, I mean, this is just so stuck in my mind. My ex and I were having some problems, and because of me, my discontent, you know. I was always wanting to be somewhere else, doing something else with someone else. And anyhow, I came home from work and I was just feeling really kind of down in the dumps. And he was going off bowling or something. And I unconsciously or consciously, I made this decision. I was going to sit down with a bottle all by myself and just drink because I was feeling down in the dumps. And I got a bottle of vermouth. And I filled the ice bucket, and I sat down on a carpet, my jammies, and worked my way through this bottle of vermouth. Something happened, though, that night, because that thought then was firmly planted in my mind. When I don't feel too good, I need a drink. And I think I hadn't thought of I need a drink until then, but then I needed a drink. And that was a real change, because I needed a drink more and more often. A couple of things just to show how my drinking went. One night, I had been out drinking with some friends of mine, and I must have fallen asleep at the wheel driving home, and I crashed my car into the showroom window of the car showroom. And the immense noise woke me up. It's pitch dark, and I think, oh my God, and I fled the scene of the crime, hoping that nobody had seen me. But somebody saw me, took down my license plate number, and the next day there was a policeman outside looking at there was hardly any damage on my car. I thought maybe I imagined it. Maybe it was just a bad dream. And then, just before I came out to the States in 1980, my ex bought this really old car because we were moving to the States just for a year. I'll get into that in a minute. But he bought me this really old car, an A40. I don't know if any of you know what it looks like, but we call it the Racing Onion. And it was built so good, a real big, hefty thing. And I was driving home one night. I remember I went airborne over what we call a humpback bridge, and I woke up. But the next thing I know, I have slammed into a cemetery wall. And I really believe that if I hadn't been in that car, because the steering wheel is humongous. Yeah. You know, and I remember coming to and thinking, oh my God, what have I done to myself? Because I was hurting, and there was steam everywhere. And that steering wheel stopped me from going through the windshield. So anyhow, I get out, somebody comes running out of the house to help me, and the front is just right up against the windshield, and the tires are all in shreds, and I'm just looking at this, and still, you know, the booze is not the problem. It's, oh my God, how did this happen? And someone called my neighbor. My ex was already here. Someone called my neighbor who had a tow truck thing, came out and put this poor car up on the wagon thing, you know, and hauled it away before the police could come. So, and that was a story of my life till I got sobering. I always managed to skim through trouble, you know. But I firmly believe that we get in here when we're supposed to. So anyhow, my ex gets a job here, working for Learjet. It's supposed to be in Tucson. It's supposed to be a one-year contract. That's all. I didn't want to come. I thought, oh, what a great opportunity. You know, we were having problems and I really didn't want to be married anymore, and I thought,
this is a perfect opportunity. I'll stay and you can go. But my mom talked me into it because she only thought it was going to be a year. Had she known it would be forever, she wouldn't have had that talk with me, I'm sure. But she said, Carol, you love to travel. You've got to go. It's only a year. It'll be wonderful. And if you don't go, you know, your marriage is going to fall apart. Well, I didn't tell her that. That's really what I hoped would happen. But anyway, so I come out to Tucson, and they have recruited a whole bunch of English guys from all over the country to go work there on this one-year contract. And we are like we're let loose because we have far more money than we need. And, you know, all our responsibilities are left back in England. And we were partying every night. Every night. If we weren't out of a bar or a club, then we were at our apartment or somebody else's apartment or in a parking clubhouse, boozing, drinking. I couldn't work because of the work permit he was on, so I was home during the day. So that was when I started drinking, you know, really early in the day. And I would get up in the morning and do a few things, start drinking around 11, watching soap operas. I really got into all the soap operas. Guiding Light, Another World, Last World, all of those. And I would drink. And then I would stop for a little while so I could get dinner ready. And then after dinner, it started again. And this is no exaggeration. I think I probably was, you know, passed out drunk every night for that first year and a half. Well, they kept extending the contract, and I remember one night sitting on a bar stool, and I don't know why I thought this. I just thought, what if I can't stop? What if I can't stop? Because I really knew, you know, my drinking was getting out of control now. But it was so terrible. It was terrible. I just had another drink. And by the end of that year, so I had been in Tucson for a year and a half, I started getting hangovers and feeling really bad. I never got hangovers up to then. And I used to say to you, oh, when I start having hangovers, I'll quit. But, you know, it was too late. And so anyhow, I was really not doing well. I thought, well, I'm going to quit. So I quit. Cold turkey. For 3 weeks. The first 2 weeks, especially the first week, I was in absolute lunatic. I couldn't sleep. I kept thinking I was going to die. I was having a heart attack. Something was wrong with everything. You know, I just was absolutely crazy. And I kept having this horrible out-of-body experience where I really thought I was going. And it was just awful. Anyhow, the third week, I calmed down, and I was feeling not too bad. And we went out, like we always did, and here I am drinking virgin drinks and club soda and not thinking about it at all. And one of our friends said, one of the couples said, oh, do you want to come back and watch? I don't know what the movie was. It was a new movie. Do you want to come back and watch this movie? I said, sure. He and my ex said, sure. And so we go around there, and the guy said, do you want a drink? And I said, yes. I mean, it just came out, yes. He poured me a rum and coke, and I don't remember anything else. I went into an immediate blackout and couldn't remember anything of what happened. I don't know how much I drank. I just remember that first one. And so from then on until I came in here, I tried to control it, and you know, it was worse than ever. And I was always getting into some kind of trouble. Somebody always had to babysit me. I would never put it on my own because I knew that something would happen. I needed somebody to take care of me. And if it wasn't my ex, then it would be one of my friends. And they all got so fed up with it. You know, I would lose my keys. We'd be out in the parking lot, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning looking for my keys. One time, somebody was flagging me down, so I pulled over. And I didn't realize that I pulled over into, like, all this sand area. And so this couple had to take me home. Next day, we had to get all our buddies to get the car out from off the sand. You know how hard that is. And it was just one thing after another. Another night, I came home, didn't have my keys. And my friend is there. I thought my ex wasn't in the apartment, so... we had no way to get in, so we had to smash patio door. Only to find out that my ex was there. And I would wake up in the morning and I would think, and I would say to my ex, "What happened last night?" And I was always afraid of what he was going to tell me, because it was always something that I had done, that I had really done something amazing. And at the end of 82, we moved to San Antonio because contract finally ended. But by now, neither of us wanted to go back to England. I was too into my drinking. I didn't want that. I couldn't imagine going back there and, kind of trying to live a normal life with all my family. So we come to San Antonio, and I start this real binge drinking where I would not be able to sober up on Monday morning, and I would drink. And if I knew if I had a drink on Monday morning, I was going back to bed. I'd go back to bed, and I would stay there for about a week, and I would just get up when I needed, might run out of liquor, and I, go to the liquor store. My ex would hide the money. He'd hide my driving license. He'd hide the keys. And I would be, rustling around, trying to find where he'd hidden them. But somehow I always found him and was able to go out and get liquor. I will get these wonderful jobs and lose them in about 6 weeks, because I had this cycle of getting up on a Monday morning, drinking, going back to bed. So that was really miserable, and really miserable for him. And so finally, I really did a number. I went on one of these binges. We were in Oklahoma City, because he traveled around wherever the contracts were. We were in Oklahoma City. And I had gone on one of my benders, and I woke up, needed more liquor, and so the liquor store is just around the corner, and I've been there many times. What I do is I rip out a check, because there was never any cash in there, write my name on the bottom, and just hand it to the liquor store clerk, and I'd be able to get other people to fill it in. My husband would fill it in. This day I got up, and I hobbled, because when I've been on one of these long benders, my back would really hurt, and like a little old lady, creeping around the corner to the liquor store in bare feet, and got my bottle, and sorry, little baby. I'm holding it like that as I walk back to the apartment, and I see my ex and all his buddies working on a car, and I just froze like a deer caught in headlights. And they all looked around and saw me, and I can't imagine what kind of mess I looked in, what I looked like, And I remember my ex said, "Look at the state of the room. Can you believe that?" And we go in the apartment, and of course he takes my booze away, and I get down on my knees and beg him to let me have my bottle of booze, and he wouldn't. And so I had to make it through the night. I vaguely remember him saying, "I'm leaving the Yellow Pages out on the table, and it's open to Alcoholics Anonymous. You better call." So I get up, and it's there. So I make it. And they put me in touch with this lady. They said there's a meeting this afternoon at 2:00. It's at her house. And so I went. And it wasn't a bit like I thought. I mean, I had no idea what AA would be like. I just thought we'd all be sitting around telling our drinking stories, and how on earth could it work. I really had never given it any thought, because I didn't want to put it. But anyhow, I walk into this lady's house, and there are 12 ladies there, I think that's 12. And 12 disciples. And they were normally doing a step study, but because I was there and I was new, they each went around and told their story. And I could not believe these women were alcoholics, because it wasn't that they were all dressed nice, they were all laughing and smiling, and they looked good. and they told a bit of their story, and so I knew what they were saying. And I loved it. And so I started going to 2 or 3 meetings a day, and I stayed sober for 3 weeks. Never going to drink again. Didn't want to. But my ex got another contract. We moved out to Tucson after 3 weeks. And I'm only there a day. And I walk across the street, out of bother. And off on another bender. Got into AA in Tucson. And I can't remember how long we were there. But then we go to, well, actually, he goes to Wake Up. And I said, that's it. We had a house here in San Antonio. So I said, that's it. I'm not traveling around anymore. You can go off where you want. I'm going back to San Antonio. I can't do the traveling anymore. And I knew that I needed AA. So I came down here. I'm sure it was a Sunday. First person I met was June in the front office. The second person was Suzanne.
Oh.
And she had long hair, little shorts. And she was pregnant with Shane. It was September of 84. So would that be right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Little shorts, pretty little top. And she talked to me. And anyhow, I started coming. But I couldn't stay sober. I wanted it. I wanted it so bad. But I would get a week or two. And it's like I'd be driving home for some reason. My car would pull in to Payless Liquor or Don and Ben's or whatever it was. And I couldn't figure out what happened. But I kept coming back because I knew y'all had the answer. And I knew that you cared about me, and nobody ever said anything mean or unkind, you know? And this is 84. It's the end of 84, and we decide we're going to go up to Michigan. To visit my ex's relatives. He had never met them. They're Polish, by the way. My ex was, my father-in-law was Polish. And we go up there, and I'm supposed to be sober, right? And I've been sober 5 whole weeks. Longest time I've ever been sober. I decided to take a bottle with me, just to be on the safe side. And I remember I have it in a tote bag. And we were at the airport, and I just set it down like that, but it clinked. Like only above the balcony. And my ex just looked at me, shook his head. Didn't say anything, just shook his head. So, but I need not worry, because when we got up there, they put us down in the basement. And down in the basement was all kinds of liquor. Liquor, champagne, liqueurs, beer. Not that I'd really ever drank beer, but... So, I would sneak down there, and anytime I wanted to, but something had happened. I could not get drunk. I couldn't get drunk. I couldn't escape. I just felt dead and empty. That's the only way I can describe it. And, that was sort of the turning point. And came back to San Antonio. It was the day before New Year's Eve. And I can't remember what happened then, but New Year's Eve, I'm home by myself, my ex is gone, so I'm home by myself watching TV, and I'm drinking Myers Platinum Rum. And I pour out the last of what I've got in the bottle. And I wasn't drunk. I mean, I had a lot, but I wasn't drunk. I poured this out. And I just felt like God tapped me on the shoulder and said, Carol, you don't have to do this anymore. I didn't hear an audible voice, but I heard it inside. And I didn't know what had happened. I really didn't process it. I had planned to come back to Club 12 in the morning, January 1st, and I remember that meeting back there in the smoke-filled room. And it was wonderful. I never smoked, but the smoke somehow didn't bother me. And we all know the stories of the thing going off and arcing and going. But I can see Buck back there. I can see Hank, probably Jim. But in there, it was like, oh.
Angels.
I started coming back to meetings, and at 2 weeks sober, I just had this thought, I've been sober for 2 weeks. And I've been sober for 2 weeks before, but I hadn't wanted to drink. It hadn't even crossed my mind. I mean, it just... And I knew that God had said that to me back on New Year's Eve. And so, I really wanted to be in this. I really wanted to work pro bono. So, May became my sponsor. Actually, I don't think she became my sponsor until I had 3 months of sobriety, because I kept looking for the perfect person, and then I was afraid to ask anybody. But what happened was, a friend of mine here had gone on a bender. She was home in bed, drunk, and I was planning to see her after the 5:30 meeting. And May said, "You've seen Missy lately?" I said, "Yeah, she's drinking again. I'm just going to go see her." And she said, "On your own?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "You have to go on your own. I'll come with you." So she came with me, and I sat and watched May try and work with Missy. And Missy did eventually get sober. But anyhow, May said, "Who's your sponsor?" I said, "Well, I don't have one." And she said, "Well, I guess I am." So she volunteered herself to be my sponsor. But a little before this, I had a horrible week. It was like it's like the EBGBs. I just was nervous and anxious, and I felt like I was going crazy. I didn't want to drink. That never crossed my mind. But I felt like I wanted to bang my head against the brick wall and just go nuts. But I kept coming to meetings, kept coming. And then one night I was home, and I looked at the clock, and it was 10 till 9. I thought I could just get to the liquor store. And I thought, no, I don't want to drink. And I fell on my knees, and I remembered, you know, that there'll come that time when nothing will be able to keep you from that drink except God. And so I got on my knees and said, "God, please don't let me drink. Please don't let me drink. Please don't let me drink." When I opened my eyes, it was 9:15, and it was too late to go to the liquor store. I don't know what happened there, but 25 minutes had gone by. And I knew then that God was keeping me sober. A little bit earlier than this, I had to tell this story about Shermer. I had just come out of a 5:30 meeting, and my ex called the office saying that we'd been broken into. And so I dash off home, and they've taken everything, all my LPs, clothes, jewelry, what have you. I was so mad. And I said, "I need a drink." But then this voice came at me that didn't sound like me, but it was me. And I said, "No, you need to go back to Club 12. So I came back to Club 12, and I really didn't want to drink. It was just, you know, the first thing that comes in your head when you're not what. I came back here. There's nobody around except Buck leaning up against the coffee bar. And he said, "Hey, English, what's up with you?" Because he always called me English. And I said, "I've just been robbed." And so I go tell him the story. He just stands there grinning the whole time. Grinning. And he said, "You didn't need any of that." Well, I didn't agree with that. He said, "You know, the main thing is that you're sober. That's all that matters." And that really set in me, you know, that was something that played in my head over and over when bad things were happening. None of this really matters. As long as I'm sober, everything will be okay. So, oh my God, too long my drunk alarm. Everything goes well. I'm coming to meetings, I'm working with Meg, she's dragging me off on 12 step calls, I know a lot of people, everything's going great. The relationship with my husband's going good. But then I met Brett. And not a lot of people were very happy about this, which is not surprising, seeing I was still married at the time. But anyhow, I had seen him before, back in maybe April or something. I was sitting right over there at the back on Sunday morning, and this tall guy with dark hair walks in. "Who's that?" And they said, "What are you looking at?" I said, "Oh, nothing. I thought I'd recognize someone." But I didn't see him again for a few months. But anyhow, he walked up to me on a Friday night. I was sitting right at the back with May, And Friday nights used to be very full in here back then, you know, as full as it is now. And he walked right over to me and said, "Are you single?" And me jumped in his face and he said, "No, she's not. She's married." That evening, we all went to gyms like we used to in our coffee, and of course, we just bonded. We just understood each other so well. How wonderful the program is. And so, you know, we were friends for a little while, and it developed into something more, and my ex found out, and I went home one night after meeting, and he was packing his bags, and I remember how scared I was, you know, that, oh, he's packing, he's really going, and I was really scared, and I didn't hear from him for several days, and in that time, you know, I settled down to the idea that this is it, you know, marriage is over, and like I said, it's not been good for a long time. What I put him through, why he stayed, I cannot imagine why anybody would have stayed with him, but he did. And you know, I feel bad about that, but I've made my amends. But anyhow, he wanted me back. I didn't want to go back. And then he met a girl in the program, and they were married in no time. So we were off the hook.
We're going, this is a miracle.
Okay. I do need to say that May had said to me, "Carol, you know, you need to put Greg on the back burner and you need to work on your marriage because you'll go on a guilt trip you won't be able to recover from." And I didn't feel guilty. I'm sorry, but I never felt guilty, Lord. But it happened. Greg and I are really active in the program. We get married on August 23rd, a year to the day that he had walked over there and asked me if I was single. George Brown had been our counselor. He married us. And life is really great. We have our little girl, Melody, and I go on that guilt trip that I couldn't recover from. I'm so glad I didn't drink. I never thought of drinking, but I could not shake this stuff. Anyhow, finally, Greg suggested we go for counseling, and it was with our assistant pastor, and he said two things. I'm sure I'd heard before, but I was ready to hear it then. He said, "Carol, you're a different person now than you were back then." And the other one was, which I love, and that is, "God meets you where you are," you know. And I walked out of there free. I didn't have that horrible guilt that had been dogging me for years. See, if I'd been working the program properly, I would have dealt with that with May, but I kept it. Just me, I'm dealing with it, right? And she said the same thing to me. She said, "You know, Carol, you have the same chance you did," because he never did, you know, get sober. And I was able to, I felt like I couldn't make it right. And of course I couldn't, only God could make it right. But you know, Greg and I both were able to make a wonderful amends for that. He passed away in 2006. He was only 56 years old, or related to alcoholism. But his family were still in England, and we were able to help them, because I'd stayed in touch with them. They still love me. I don't know why, but they did. We were able to help them arrange the funeral over here, and, you know, be able to take his ashes back to England. And after the funeral, we met at Starbucks. His mom and his sister and his brother and sister-in-law, and we sat around and talked and laughed, and I thought, how could this be? You know, how could that happen? That God orchestrated that, where I could really make amends. We both could make amends to him and his family. And then we have Melody's born, we have our twin boys are born in 1990, and because of, I meant to say something, AA, all the people in AA did our reception. They did all the food for our reception. And when I had the boys, I had three AA baby showers. So much clothes, I didn't know what to do with that. Well, life goes along really, really well for us all through the 90s. well, raising the kid, and I have brilliant memories of raising the kids, so they probably wouldn't have said it was so wonderful, but it was wonderful. And we made the mistake, another mistake that may blow me off, we made the mistake of getting too involved in church. And Maya told me that church and AA are two paths. They run parallel. Sometimes they meet and cross, but they are two separate paths. And we somehow forgot and felt much too involved in church. You know, if it was a fundamental church and, you know, you're kind of held to a high standard. We hold our kids to a high standard. They have a lot to live up to. And, you know, when they come into their teenage years, you know, we are Al-Anons on steroids. You know, trying to figure out all their every move, what they do, and it wasn't good. And it, you know, I'm sure that people suggested Al-Anon to us, but I don't know why we didn't go. But we finally ended up going. I can't remember what year it was, but thank God for Al-Anon. But that, it was hard for me to get a hold of. I, you know, I really believed in it, but I will keep jumping in between my husband, Greg, and the kids, because I was trying to protect them. You know, I think moms are Al-Anons by nature, you know, you want to protect your kids, and so anyhow, I was always jumping in there and trying to fix things, trying to be the peacemaker, trying to make things right, and I couldn't do it. And so I think I'm doing a whole lot better. I did slip up the other week, and my son told me that I was butting in and to leave the whole thing alone. But I'm so grateful for this program because it has the principles for all of our lives. It's not just getting sober, it's family relations, and that's what I really need. We all went on a cruise in January, all of us. That was fun and interesting, and toward the end of the cruise, everybody got a scratchy throat, including me. Well, they all got over it in a day or so, not me. I get worse and worse, and it ends up being a really bad chest infection. I'm sick as a dog. And I eventually go to a doctor, and I love this doctor because it's like meeting with a sponsor, because she doesn't just deal with your physical well-being, she deals with your mental and emotional stuff. And one of our first questions was, what about stress in your life? I don't have any stress. And so she started asking me a couple of questions, and I'm crying. And and it, you know, it's been a long time getting well, but the neat thing about it is, I did another fourth and fifth step, because I found out I had some lingering resentment that I needed to deal with, that I have for quite some time, had to deal with that. And I discovered something else too. I could always say I don't regret my past, but I regretted my more recent past. I wish it had been different. I wish we'd raised the kids different. I wish that we had been different with them. And I had let that really settle in on me. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was able to let that go. And during this time, I've really done not just support and fist stuff, but some really looking deeper into, you know, what makes me tick, and what I can do to be better, to really live this program. I always loved May's program. You know, she was tough, but she had a really soft side to her. When she would talk about this program, she'd tear up, and she would talk about the wonder of the program. And it is. It's wondrous. You know, because how does it work? No church works like this. No other organization can work like this. Mm-hmm. But AA, you know, the tolerance, the love and tolerance and the acceptance in here, no matter where you've come from, what you've done. And I love that I can go anywhere on the planet. I can go back to England and go to an AA meeting. I can go to cruise and go to an AA meeting. I can go wherever I like. And it's just the same. No matter where you are, you walk in and you feel at home immediately. You could even be talking a different language. And that is just miraculous to me. So, thank you for listening to me.
Big girl! Woohoo!